Hello, my name is Noura Al-Masri. Welcome to Echoes of Impact with Noura. We believe that everyone is capable of making an impact and changing the world around them. So we challenge limitations and uncover stories that inspire a greater impact for you and the world. I can't wait to talk to my guest today. We're talking about the international relation. We're talking about nonprofits, how can and changing countries and having women in position also that you don't usually see women on. So I'm going to talk to this incredible guest today about that and more. So I want you to stay with me until the end of the episode. I want you also to write to me. Write to me at hello@echoesofimpact.net, hello@echoesofimpact.net, if you want us to discuss a certain topic about business or nonprofit, about sharing some stories. If you want to share your story or your business story, or you would like to be a guest at Echoes of Impact, I would love to talk to you, the team. Here at Echoes of Impact, one of us will be talking to you to see if you are a great fit for the show, and we would love to have you. So make sure you email me hello@echoesofimpact.net. Today, as we're talking about foreign relations, international relationship, or not relationship, international relation and policy making and all of these things, and how that can affect nonprofits, and how can that affect countries. I'm going to talk about a very important topic in this segment. Again, this segment is sponsored by Noura's books, Save Taxes with Noura. So we're going to talk about an international and an interesting topic. You might have heard of it because I talk about it a lot. Even when I wrote a chapter on tax strategies for small businesses, I actually wrote about it. It's FBAR. If you have not heard about FBAR, FBAR is Foreign Bank Account Report. It's Foreign Bank Account Report. This is from the Treasury Department, a Treasury Department requirement. If you have a foreign bank account, especially if you have a business outside, or if you have like just a bank account or security account, something financial in the financial institution account, and you have equivalent to $10,000 at any time during the year, $10,000 at any time during the year, even if one day, even if 1 minute, you know, the statement came out with equivalent to $10,000 on that day, you want to make sure to report an FBAR. That reporting is different than the tax return. You have to do it with the Treasury Department. Of course, if a lot of people are not comfortable doing that on their own, you can definitely hire someone to do it. At Noura's Books, we do this all the time for our clients. You have to report that to the IRS. Now, a lot of people are confused between reporting and paying taxes. When you report something to the Treasury Department, to the IRS, it doesn't mean you're paying taxes on it. For example, FBAR might have that money, but it's not income and it's not, so you don't have to pay taxes on it. Actually, you don't pay taxes on an FBAR. You just have to let the Treasury Department know that, hey, I have this much money in this account, in this country, at this time, and I had this much money there. That's it, technically. You, of course, you have to fill out a form, and that's what you need to do in order to report this to Treasury Department. This is, again, totally different than doing that and doing your taxes. However, when you do your taxes, you have to let your accountant know, because there is a form the accountant should attach to your tax returns to tell them, yes, you have a foreign bank account. And then there is another question asking if you have a reporting requirement or not. So you do have to let your accountant know, even if you are filing the FBAR for on your own. So in Noura's books, we do have that questionnaire and you can just answer the questions there. Some accountants don't have that questionnaire, but even if they do not ask you or they do not have that, you know, like it's a busy time, they might have forgot to ask you, you need to let them know. So they can include that form in your taxes. And if you need help with doing the FBAR, you need to also ask for that. This does not go automatically. And you want to be careful when you're talking to an accountant. Don't expect the account, just because you hired the accountant to do your taxes, she's going to do everything for you. Every service has different things. When you buy something from Amazon, you do not expect Amazon going to send you their entire inventory, right? So make sure you do not have a realistic expectation. But I do want to talk more about FBAR. Just to explain what does it mean and when do you know that you need to file FBAR. For example, your aunt has an account in Canada, okay? And she has you as someone signatory there. You are a signer in her account. This is not your money. She just have your name there just in case, just for emergency. And she has an FBAR requirement, or even if she doesn't have, she might not be a US person, meaning US citizen or US taxpayer. You still have to file FBAR, even if this is not your money. You would explain that in the FBAR form, but you still have a requirement. And if you think the Treasury Department wouldn't know, well, they know, because banks all around the world, they have the requirements to report that to the US Treasury. So they will know. And if you haven't been doing FBAR, you can make it up and you can file for different years. Otherwise, they don't care if you know or don't know. So even if you don't know, you still get penalties. And the penalties can be $100,000. Or half of your money. So is that really high penalty? While if you want to file the FBAR, it could be for free if you do it yourself. It could be for a few hundreds if you are using a service. So that's much cheaper. And you don't want to get in trouble saying this is the Protection Act that happens with the Treasury Departments have. So you should comply with it. Otherwise, you might be even in jail. So it's not worth it to be in jail. And speaking about that, another requirement of the Treasury Department is BOI, the beneficial ownership information. That was that they were talking about it last year. And the deadline was supposed to be December 31st, 2024. And they kind of blocked it and had a hold on it, and they brought it back now. So it's required again, and it should happen by March 22nd. That's the deadline, March 22nd. So if you haven't filed your BOI yet, make sure you do it. We also offer this service at Noura's Books. So you want to make sure to report to Treasury Department, whatever you are required to report. FBAR, if you have a foreign bank account that had $10,000 at any point during the year, or even if not you, even if it's your business account, but it's a, you know, if you are a US person, it doesn't matter if it's under your name or your company name. So you must still report it into the Treasury Department, even if you are a nonprofit. So everyone is required to report it. And then the other thing, the BOI, you need to report. So these are two important reporting to Treasury Department. They are not tax filing. They are required. There is a lot of penalty for BOI. If you don't file, you're going to pay $500 a day or maybe a little bit more. I didn't check the latest, but let's Consider it $500 a day. That's a lot. That's a lot of money just for not doing a simple reporting. And you can definitely use a tax professional, use an accountant to do that. We do offer this service at Norris Books. So make sure you stay in compliance so you don't spend your money on unnecessary things. You want to make sure you take care of your money. How do you take care of your money? Not with not investing in your business, but with really making sure you do not spend money in penalties and interest when you don't have to. So make sure you stay on top of your business. Make sure you stay up into of your personal finances and taxes, and don't get into somewhere that just because you got lazy or you're afraid of something, don't know about it, and then you just ignore it and it's gonna hit you back. So don't go there. Make sure you consult with an accountant. I would love to have you. You can simply book a call with my team at norrisbooks.com/contacts, norrisbooks.com/contacts. Again, this segment is sponsored by Norris Books. Save taxes with Noura. I love this segment because I love one of our core value at Norris Books is education, and I love to let you know what I wish someone could let me know before I started in this tax and compliance world. So stay with me. We're gonna have a great guest. We're going to again to talk about a lot of exciting issues, a lot of exciting topics that's gonna benefit you, whether you are in nonprofits or you are involved in any way or form in nonprofits. So stay with me. I'm sure a lot of you supporting somehow supporting in some way or form to any nonprofit, church, mosque. So stay with me. This is gonna give you a lot of information. The guest I have is incredible, and I can't wait to talk to her and for you all to listen to what she has to say. Again, this is your host, Noura Al-Masri, and this is Echoes of Impact with Noura. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is your host, Noura Al-Masri, and this is Echoes of Impact with Noura. I'm excited to talk to my guest today. As we're talking about foreign accounts and we're talking about international things now today in this episode, we're going to talk to an expert in that field, international relations. Sally, she is a senior advocacy officer. She works with a very well-known organization in the Syrian community and in Syria in general. Welcome, Sally. Sally, thank you so much for accepting my invitation to the show today. How are you today?
Very good. Thank you for having me, Noura. And it was great to meet you in DC a few weeks back. And thanks to your team also for bearing with all the technical challenges here.
Of course, we are glad to have you here. I'm very excited to talk to you about this interesting topic. And to see a great woman like you doing a lot of work in the UN and a lot of great work, a lot of representation for Syria, for your organization. And it's a topic, I don't know, like, you tell me before we start, like, do you see a lot of women in your field?
Definitely not.
I
In fact, I can count probably twice the times that I have been to spaces where there were other women than me. So probably two, a total of two women in those spaces. Only twice in a career of 4 years.
Wow. So how do you see like your job? Is it challenging to be like one of very, very few women? Like how do you see the environment of your work in general?
It's so the environment of the work that I do, which is an international relations, although I do work from home, which from the very first look of it sounds very easy or convenient. It's not at all. Having to manage the house, manage, be with my daughter and perform at work, and then travel when works needs it. With international relations, you really don't know when the meetings are or where ahead of, much time. And so therefore, this flexibility is required, but also it takes a toll, physically, mentally, personally, you name it. But it's also very exciting though, right? Because you're not only bounded to the role that's in the office, right? Or being in the office or being in this one single role of I don't know, maybe writing reports or responding or coordinating. So the advocacy officer position really acts with or interacts with countries. So in my capacity, I meet with UN missions. I meet with countries, in capitals of countries. So I travel to European capitals, for example, to DC. I meet with congressional representatives, senates, the administration here in the United States. So that's very, very interesting. Very, it really drives a person's comfort zone only wider and wider. But at the same time, that requires a lot of flexibility, which in some cases, is challenging to women.
Absolutely. So this is very interesting. And before we go in depth in your work, I'm really interested. I'm sure like people asking, like, how did you find yourself in this position? Like, why did you take the international relation part? You could be doing anything else, of course, like anyone else, but what's really attracted you? Tell me a little bit about the background of your work. How did you find yourself here?
So it's a very long story, but the short version is that I'm Syrian. So I was born and raised in Syria in Damascus, and I moved here when I was 17 and a half, right after the revolution erupted in Syria, and I was part of that. I demonstrated the government, the regime of Bashar al-Assad, and was kicked and beaten, and quite a story there, but I said, well, you know what? I'm not gonna stop this, and I have to do it in a different capacity. And so, out of these protests, I started working with civil society there, organizing the protests, providing humanitarian aid and assistance to those who flooded Damascus in the months after, coming from Aleppo, Homs, and the suburbs of Damascus. And then when I came here, I couldn't just turn my back and not do anything for my country anymore. And so I, again, engaged with civil society here. And although every Syrian's family dreams of having a doctor and an engineer amongst their ranks, my family always pressured me to go that route. I did register for that. And 3 years later, I switched from biology back to political science. I just couldn't, just stay away. It was, to me, it was personal. It was my country, it was my people, the organizations that I worked for and helped establish. And I found healing in that. And it didn't feel like work, right, at the beginning. And so from there, my journey started in political science. And then I got my master's in international relations. I went to study in the United Kingdom in Oxford, and that's where I really started to get a taste of what international relations means, because the politics that I was learning here, and I don't mean the science, right? The political, not the political science, but the politics, the way of teaching in class, the debates, the way that I was pretty much brought to become a political scientist were different than those in the United Kingdom. And that intrigued me even more to pursue a job in this field. Not just, stick to a think tank, for example, or academia. And soon after, I got this job with the Syrian Forum, and New York, the United Nations, amazing, amazing opportunity, and I'm very grateful for it. I'm learning a lot.
Impressive. That's amazing. And I'm glad to see young women like you, beautiful women, working in the UN and working on actually the Syrian cause, which is a cause that dear to my heart, like any other Syrian. So, and I see that a lot of young Syrians, like when they were teenager like you, and when this revolution started, a lot of them took similar route, like somehow like nonprofit route. Like I myself like found myself working on nonprofit, even though I'm technically an accountant. So so yeah, like it's amazing how the revolution can revolutionize your life. So yeah, thank you so much for sharing. And now what exactly do in your current job, like what I know you mentioned, like you work from your home and you have to attend meetings and stuff, but what exactly, how does that impact what's in Syria? Like how, what's your role technically?
Okay, so very good question. It might sound a little bit technical, but so the work that we do is, so for the first, for the 13, 14 years that Assad has ruled Syria during this revolution, there was only one voice in such international venues like the United Nations. Also, diplomatically speaking with some Arab states, there was only this one diplomatic route that existed, which was the regime's route. But to, in order to counter that and to get the voice of the Syrian people who were besieged, brutalized and killed and kicked and forced to flee to Europe and ride the sea, in order to do that, we had to find a vehicle to get our voices there. And so the civil society organizations, although in some country contexts, they're charity work. They are maybe the Red Cross, like, right? Maybe they're churches. Maybe they're like here in the United States, we see pantries, right? Food on wheels. I'm not sure if I said that right, but there, you know, there are different purposes. In the case of Syria, we had to diversify now to include advocacy as a very important tool and means to get this voice to those strategic, you know, politically strategic capitals like Washington, London, Brussels, Paris, Istanbul, since it's in the region. And in order for us to do that, we needed to build capacity in terms of advocacy. What is advocacy? What does it mean? How can we engage with these countries? They're countries. Why would they listen to me and to my colleagues or other organizations, right? And so we started, we went back to the basics. So advocacy is this, advocacy is intervening, interacting with a stakeholder. So be it a country, be it a company, it could be a company, you know, like Goldman Sachs, talking to them to intervene and change in a policy that they have. So we're not asking for a whole new policy. We're not asking to change, shift course, right? And change, for example, the priorities, the national security threats, what they define as threats or no, we're basically, we intervene in order to tell the US government, for example, hey, in order for you to achieve national security goals in this region, you need to do this 1, 2, 3 for Syria, and it would help you stabilize the region. And so, for example, that is advocacy, and that requires analysis and studying of those countries and their politics. And that's where international relations is really embedded in this whole process. We can get civil society organizations like the one I work for, Syrian Forum, has programs on the ground. They're relief and humanitarian. We have constituents. Those are our the families that we help, which, by the way, amount to hundreds of thousands of families. And then we hear things, we see challenges that are limiting our ability to deliver aid. So we take this need and we talk about it politically. And then you have any political science student or expert say, okay, you know what? We need to talk to this government. And this is the policy that we need to tackle. And then you bring in the international relations expert to tell you how to translate this to each country that we meet with. So when I sit and meet with Liechtenstein and Luxembourg, it's a different conversation than when I meet with France and the United States, for example. And it's completely different when I meet with Saudi Arabia. And this is the international relations skills and knowledge. And then we take that and then we take, you know, have these meetings and talk about these policy changes in order for us to influence this change. Now, it's such a cumulative work. It takes a lot of time to build and see change. Also, you need multiple actors, because sometimes maybe the CRN forum is, always comes from this background perspective. So we need another organization. So the more organizations that there are that call for the same thing, the more likely that we will see this change. And so that's really what happened in the first 4 or 5 years. This was not so strong in this case of Syria, but then it really ramped up. We saw the Caesar Act got passed, the Captagon Act got passed. We are really the single country that was able to push hardly on an NGO level to get that sort of legislation passed. Almost every year there was a peace on Syria, and that's massive to achieve. And
That's
so,
awesome.
yes.
I'm going to continue this conversation with you after the break. So remember where you stopped so we can continue. Thank you so much, Sally, for sharing that. Guys, we have to take a break now for and we're gonna come back. This is your host, Noura Masri, and this is Echoes of Impact with Noura. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is your host, Noura Masri, and this is Echoes of Impact with Noura. We're back with my guest for today, Sally. Sally, so sorry to cut you before the break, but it was very interesting points you're bringing. So yeah, so what else were you able to achieve for Syria?
We were able to, for example, pursue just before Assad fell in December, as the armed groups were, pursuing Damascus, they were on the outskirts of Homs. We were in The Hague working on an initiative to pursue the situation in Syria to the International Criminal Court, for example. So the work and advocacy goes hand in hand with developments on the ground. We're trying to, for example, right now, get the international court system to work with a national court initiative to bring in those gross human rights violators, the criminals of Assad, the warlords, Captagon mafia to courts. And in order for us to identify those criminals, we're going to need international mechanisms, evidence tracking, mass graves, evidence collection and protection. And we're talking about large scale accountability and justice work. And just to put this into perspective, there half of the population in Syria is displaced, whether inside Syria or outside. There's an estimated 1.5 million in Germany, a million in about, I think, Netherlands, and a few hundreds of thousands scattered in other countries in Europe. There's 3 million Syrian refugees in Turkey. There is 1.5 million in Lebanon, and also, don't quote me on Jordan, but could be a million or so. So we're talking about millions of Syrians that need to go back to their country, that need infrastructure to go back, that need not to be pursued if they go back to rebuild their country, that for people like me who were able to establish life and be of, and work in a strategic role to help the country outside, still be empowered to stay outside, right? So all of this is just a lot. It cannot be taken, this whole burden cannot be, lifted by only one NGO. And therefore there's about, there are hundreds of NGOs right now working. Some specialize in humanitarian relief, some specialize in development, some work on women and children rights and empowerment. And so the Syrian American Medical Society is an example of that. The White Helmets, the Syrian Civil Defense, which happen to be two of our allies when it comes to Syria on the ground, we have an operational alliance that allowed us to combine. What my organization does is relief, development, education, and infrastructure with the civil defense that that has the machinery and the, for example, the ambulance vehicles, police cars, and also with the SAMS, the Syrian American Medical Society, that specialized in the medical field. So all three organizations came together to rebuild and reboost the infrastructure in Northwest Syria. And we've been very successful at it ever since the earthquake. We said, you know what, if the earthquake brought everything down, we just have to build it up the right way. And that's when we started building these coalitions on the ground and also in advocacy. So now when I go to meetings, I know exactly where my partners stand at, where we share consensus. So I speak with a stronger tone. Similarly, in the United States here, we have the American Coalition for Syria. It's a coalition of many organizations that also advocate on the Hill and in Washington, D.C. And, you know, I'm just very proud to be such part of a group. I'm proud to be part of such a group because we broke barriers. You know, we talk from, like, sometimes when I interact with my colleagues in London and in the UK, we talk about Washington and London, and we're in full, you know, we're in it's concerted effort, right? And it's in harmony. And I just love that because it's hard to also see a population in such a context like we are work together in the way that we are. Yes, there are differences, right? And I'm not going to deny that, but there's always a way that we learn to overcome these differences. And that's what I love about us. We're very flexible and we always learn.
Absolutely. So, like, those organizations, are they only your partners on the ground, or do I also work in the UN where you go, or you represent all of them at the same time when you go there?
No. So we are only partners on the ground. We are partners when it comes to the American Coalition for Syria. When I go meet countries, the United Nations, I meet them in the name of the Syrian Forum. For example, knowing that accountability and justice are a priority for them. So every time I bring this up to a country at the UN, I bring it up with a stronger position that I know that, you know, X, Y, and Z organizations are with me on this page. And sometimes when they're here, we do go on tours together. So I help set up meetings for them and we go and we meet. And each one, you know, each representative then brings the points that they want to bring. But it's, I just love that we're not fighting, right? So it's.
Awesome. So you made me think about, like, a lot of organizations in general, not just in Syria case, like nonprofit organizations. There's a rule come there, something comes up, like, and they get, okay, what do we do? They think it's a barrier. We don't do anything. Maybe larger organizations think about UN, but even with the larger, like, not many, I guess, a lot of people, like, think, oh, we can't do this, and that's it. So what's the solution for them? If they don't have the capacity to have someone like you, like, who can represent the organization in the UN, is there a solution, like, where can they, I don't know, like, what to ask you exactly, but, like, how can they change?
I think I got your question right. So you mean if there's an organization that's far, far away, cannot be here and talk to these missions, right? So what's the solution? There are multiple solutions that can go from, you know, these partnerships that we have, the work that we do, the meetings that we have. And when they say, yes, please, you can, when we sign letters, when we create a letter and we sign it and we send it to these countries, for example, they can have their name there and we can have it a joint letter. So it's a written participation. So it's not a meeting as we're doing right now, but could be written. So that's one way. The second way is they can still set up meetings virtually. And the third way is during the conferences that we have here at the United Nations. One very famous conference is the United Nations General Assembly, UNGA Week in New York, where everybody comes and they meet with leaders, and it's on a ministerial level. So they can come in for a visit for 1 week and meet with as many countries as they would like. The fourth one is, and if they can't get a visa, is to engage with the capitals. So what I like about, you know, working in the diplomatic field is that there's a diplomatic system. So it doesn't have to be, I don't have to meet them at the United Nations. It just so happens we're lucky in the United States. We have 190 countries located in New York that we can talk to. And so if I have, you know, let's just say, someone who's refugee status, has a refugee status in Europe and works does what I do for work, can come here, they can still seek them in their capital. So they'd be going in to Berlin, to Paris, to Madrid, and talk to these capitals. Obviously, it's a little bit more expensive, but luckily travel is cheap in Europe. That's what I hear. So
But what about
do
people?
that.
There's a lot of organization, nonprofit organizations in the US, yet they don't understand they can have an impact on the UN, on the rules that's going to stay away, like keep them away from the impact they are looking to have. So, and they don't, they may be like, oh, like, are we allowed to go to the UN? Is it
Yeah.
open for everyone? What do, who do, how do we know what do, who do we have to see? Like, so can you just like briefly talk about this?
Yes, so the 1, 2, 3 steps you mean to doing this work. So there's two things that we can do at the United Nations for any nonprofit. This goes for any nonprofit. It goes from the church that we have down the street to the largest of the largest, like the Red Cross, for example, right? Just as an example. So two things. The first is we can get accredited, and a nonprofit could get accredited by the United Nations to participate in each conference that the UN has anywhere in Nairobi, Kenya, in Vienna, Austria, in Geneva, Switzerland, in New York, in the United States. So to get accredited, there's an application. There's a process called the ECOSOC consultative status. And so ECOSOC stands for Economic and Social Council. So this is the council that runs the United Nations programs in terms of population, migration. There's, in fact, you've probably heard of the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals. I have them here. You've probably seen them, or at least the logo. They're like 17 goals that talk about sustainable communities and populations, education, hygiene, environment, oceans. So all of that. So any organization that does anything related to those 17 goals, which are very broad, by the way, are welcome to apply to get this accreditation. Once you get the accreditation, you get the badge, and you can go anywhere in any building and have events even organized inside those UN buildings. So right now, I know next month, I'm sorry, next week, I'm still February mentality, still stuck in February, but March 10th is the first day of the UN conference on women. So this is a very, well, for me, it's sentimental. This is where I shifted from biology to political science studies. And so to me, this conference is really means a lot also to me as a Syrian woman. The other way though that you can engage on what we're doing and do what I'm doing
We're
without
going
me.
to talk about like the other way after the break. So come back with us after the break. Sally's gonna talk the other and all the other way to get engaged. So this is Echoes of Impact with Noura. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is your host, Noura Al-Masri, and this is Echoes of Impact with Noura. We're back with Sally, and she's going to talk to us about other ways to get engaged with the UN. So, Sally, welcome back.
Thank you. The other way, really, I'm just going to summarize, is to seek out the agencies that make up the United Nations. So instead of going to a conference to meet people and to be present as your own NGO, you can start working your way up while you get that accreditation, while you get the recognition and the badge, to talk to each one of those countries and each one of those agencies, build rapport and advance your agenda and your goals. So talk to Sierra Leone if they are sitting on, let's just say, the budget committee for something that is going on in Sierra. So if you're an NGO in Sierra Leone and there's no funding, right? So you can really, but this requires a lot of seeking information and research. So you need to find out which countries sit on which committees. And for example, right now the Human Rights Council is in session. There are 47 countries members of that council. They rotate. So 47, we can reach out to one of them to advance a very important human rights violation, incident that happened, and they can bring that out in the council. So that's, for example, the work that we do without the badge, because the CRN Forum is not yet accredited by the United Nations. We are in the process. It's a lengthy process, but we are happy to, there are only three organizations that have it right now. And what is the United Nations but a huge and giant NGO that whose budget is in the billions, right? And is funded by countries. The United Nations itself is a big NGO, so we need to keep that in mind. They're not a country.
So is it easier to get funded than if you get accredited from the UN?
Absolutely. It adds, so when you get the accreditation, that means your impact and your influence and your reach are far higher. And so then that allows these agencies of the United Nations to then do projects with you, right? So they feel more confident doing these projects. So if you go with the first route, you have the accreditation, you talk to UNICEF, let's do this for children in Jordan. And then they feel like, oh yeah, of course you're accredited, why not? So that kind of eases the process. If you go route two, then you have to be talking to UNICEF, building rapport, inviting them over, talking, and showing them your work. Until then, you do this project with UNICEF with low budget. And then with time, the UN goes like, oh, X NGO is such a good partner with UNICEF. Let's just invite them over to this conference, give them the badge. So there are two routes, really. Yeah.
Absolutely. So thank you so much for the information. And I want to go back to Syrian Forum. Now, Syrian Forum, can you tell us a little bit about the organization? Kind of like mention a little bit, but I would like to mention maybe like give us some examples of the work the Syrian Forum does and what exactly.
So the Syrian Forum is an NGO that was established 11 years ago by three Syrian American men, Yasser Tabara, Ghassan Hito, and Ammar Qahaf. It's multidimensional, multi-sectoral organization that tackles the issues not from one angle but multiple angles, meaning we have a think tank that researches the problems and challenges we face when our relief and humanitarian development program is in work. So our guys at Ehsan, they're distributing aid, and they also build schools. They have women and children protection centers. They do provide grants for small businesses, and for example, alternative energy, solar panels. They help the population understand how to get out of the camp, the life in the camp, to having an economically empowered life. So, but then the think tank does this research and then guides us what to do. And then when and then they identify these challenges that then the advocacy team, which is us, takes it to the other level. There's also a third, a third program, but fourth department. That's the economic empowerment program, which is now in this current context of Syria after the fall of the regime, is our top priority. It's the number one element, and and it's the center of any of the nation building strategy wherever you look. So as we shift from relief to nation building, now we need to put emphasis on economic empowerment, on in bringing investments to Syria, on building capacity of the Syrian population, bridging the gap between those Syrians in Europe and Syrians in the camp, and yet Syrians that are still in the capital that were not able to jobs, and so they had to write so in their with their own certificate, their own degrees. So I'm very proud to say that we've put 40,000 people to work, and 40,000 families therefore have been lifted out of poverty. We're able to build three schools, 100% funded by Syrians that follow a Syrian a strategy, Syrian-led strategy, which means that, this is not UNICEF for giving us money to go build a school based on UNICEF standards. This is us choosing the standards that we want to live by, want to create a generation by, and building these schools for. And so we really followed the US model here. So the three schools are equipped with labs, are equipped with computer labs, are equipped with different sports facilities. So really, they're like campuses, right? And we also have one of the largest single donor databases in terms of the Syrian, CSOs, civil society organizations, CSOs. We have about 14,000 donors. So that also puts us at a very different level when it comes to advocacy. So when I go talk to countries, I'm not funded by some foreign government to tell me what to advocate for, right? I'm funded by Syrians. And that's also very important in the think tank aspect, because the studies that we publish are also Syrian funded. Now, look, now after the fall of the regime, we're moving headquarters to Damascus. So we're moving from Istanbul to Damascus. We can't, I mean, I can't believe this is happening. The entire team didn't. It was surreal for all of us. We have a goal to achieve by June 1st to move everybody there, obviously if they want to go. That's amazing. And yeah,
This
that's
is
this
amazing.
year.
And I want to emphasize here, like, I always talk about individual donors and how nonprofits should really build a strong donor base, especially now, like we see, like cutting the federal funding, stopping the
The
USAID.
USAID, wow. Yeah.
Yeah,
That splashed us.
so yeah, tell me a little bit, like, did that affect your work at all?
Yeah. Well, USAID, we just got our first USAID grant in August. We applied for it, I believe, January or February. And then after the due diligence and the compliance and the whole thing that you have to do for USAID to approve you, finally, they did it in August. And now we've lost it. It amounts to about $8 million, which accounts for around 30% of our budget. And that's 30% of our budget. I also heard 27% of the White Helmets budget is out. SAMS is the same thing. There's a total of $20 million the Syrian civil society have lost because of the USAID budget. I mean, USAID terminations. They sent terminations. I mean, from my contacts in DC, I know now that they've sent 5,000 termination letters.
Wow.
Organizations only kept a few hundred, I believe 300 or so. But that is, I mean, I'm feeling it in the Syrian context because we're an NGO, but then think about the broader context. When you put Syria, this many terminations, Iraq, this many terminations, Jordan, this many terminations, and Turkey. And so you have an entire region that's going to have instability. And then, zoom out the entire world. And you'll see Africa, doomed to hunger. So it's very challenging.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Sally. Thank you for all the work
Thank
you
you for
do.
having me. Thank you,
Of course,
Noura.
I
It's
love
a
having
fun
you so much.
conversation.
Thank you for being here with us at Echoes of Impact. I'm sure a lot of people got a lot of value from you. Those who wants to go the same route that you want in your career, and those NGOs and nonprofits who are really still relying on grants or still looking for grants. And you see how when Syrian Farm Law and other organization lost the USAID fund and the grant funding, that which made only 30%. This is the percentage I always tell you guys to keep that as grants and rely on your donor base. Build a strong donor base in order for your organization not to fail and to stay strong. See, this is a right example. This is a perfect example. So go build your organization based on donor base. Be the strong organization, no matter what happened. It only takes a portion of your budget, not your entire organization down. Thank you so much, Sally, again.
Thank you,
How,
Noura, for having me.
of course, one more question. How can people support Syrian Forum and your work?
Oh, you can't think. Well, that's a very important question.
Yes.
And it's funny, I didn't even bring it up, but you can support the Syrian Forum by donating. You'll find it on our website, the Syrian Forum USA.org. You can donate, you can sponsor an orphan right now in Ramadan. It's only $95 a month. You can also do a monthly donation, so you can subscribe to a monthly donation, and all tax deductible, of course. And last but not least, you can also follow us on our social media everywhere. You'll find us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, the whole
Thank
set.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank
Guys,
you.
support Syrian farms, support Syrians while we are rebuilding the country. And before I leave, don't forget to email me at hello@echoesofimpact.net. hello@echoesofimpact.net. Until next time, keep making an impact.